Chapter 8. Helotyne, Imperial-held city of Escadan. Before the invasion, Escadan had been a city that vaunted achievement and excellence in all its forms. Unlike the labyrinthine Canticus or the towering industrial stacks of Sollust, Escadan had been a bastion of light where the great and gifted were exalted like gods. Statues and petroglyphs celebrating the world's luminaries lined the concourses to its many cenotaph and stadia. Historians, scientists, ecclesiarchs, and artisans were all honored in marble, onyx, agate, and carnelian. When war came, the exalted were trampled just as easily as their lessers, bloody conflict ever the great leveler. A veritable cavalcade of exquisitely detailed statuary punctuated the galleria to the grand amphitheater Drakgard had chosen as his headquarters in the city. It was expansive, though its beauty had been no defense during the outbreak of hostilities. It was the first place the Allied Imperial forces had secured and liberated, but many of the alabaster renderings that greeted visitors to the arena itself were mutilated in some fashion. Intended to recount the athletic achievements performed here, now they were a stark reminder of what Escadan and indeed Helotyne had lost because of the war. Stark magnesium lamps had been erected around a relatively small area in the center of the amphitheater. Drakgard stood within the cordon of light, just breaching the penumbra at its edge as he pored over a hololithic map table whilst awaiting the summoned officers and the new arrivals. Eliseus had joined him, having followed from the preceptory roof.
"Why here, brother captain, if you don't mind me asking?"
"I do not," Drakgard replied stiffly, his attention on the map that showed an uncomfortable number of red zones where the enemy still held territory. Since initial engagement, the pattern on the map had shifted as the Black Legion migrated from region to region, halting briefly to fight, before moving on again like ash nomads. As of yet, Drakgard had been unable to detect any strategy in it.
"It helps me think," said the captain at length.
He looked up, taking a rare break from his strategizing.
"Here,"
he gestured to the expansive amphitheater. He did not know its name, for there were none left alive to tell it, at least that he had met, but it hardly mattered.
"In this sliver of light, I am an island. Around me is darkness, obscuring, obfuscating, but here, in the light, I can see clearly."
"A little more poetic than I had you down for, Urzan," said Eliseus.
"My mind isn't closed off to it, as some would believe. I merely find little use for it."
The chaplain laughed, and the sound echoed, but there was irony to his mirth.
"Are you sure it isn't metal and cybernetics beneath your skin instead of flesh?"
"Would that it was," Drakgard replied bitterly, and went back to the map table. Just beyond the edge of the oval of light cast by the lamps, a small group of serfs and Departamento Munitorum logisticians examined data concerning supply lines, ammunition stores, casualty rates, and engagement reports. Drakgard had them feed him every one through his battle helm's retinal lens display.
"Canticus is the dam," muttered Drakgard as he surveyed the map and the troop dispositions on it again. "Breach it, and we will flood this world with our wrath. None could escape it."
Eliseus was about to respond when he heard footsteps echoing from one of the concourses that led into the amphitheater. They sounded unhurried but purposeful, and lighter than a fully armored Adeptus Astartes would make. Three females, tall and armored in the black of the ebon chalice, with white chasubles beneath, accented by crimson inner fabric, emerged into the arena. Though they were shrouded by shadow, Eliseus had some time to examine them as they made their way across to where the salamanders awaited in the cordon of light.
Two were stern-faced, their age hard to determine. One, a canoness by the look of her trappings, had harder eyes that spoke of centuries of warfare. Votive chains, attached to censers trailing prayer incense, hung from her battle plate. A pair of braziers, slaved to a small reservoir of promethium, crested the rounded stabilizer jets of her power armor's generator. She carried a power mace tied off at her hip by a leather thong, and on the opposite hip wore a holstered fusion pistol. Her hair was cropped short and the silver of polished gunmetal. The other was marginally less grizzled, but carried a scar down the left side of her face that must have come close to taking her eye. The scar extended across her scalp, however, cutting a channel into coal black hair that was flecked with white. Across the unmarred side of her face, she had tattooed an icon of the ebon chalice, presumably to guard her sight from further harm. A bolter was mag-locked to her thigh, the stock modified and shortened with a combination flamer attachment. On the other side, she had locked her helmet, which was pure white, and marked above the helm's retinal lenses with the same icon she had tattooed on her face. Her sidearm was a bolt pistol, but in her gauntleted hands she cradled a leather book and not a weapon. Purity seals adhered to her armor, held in place by red nubs of wax stamped with the Order's holy sigil. Not as tall or broad as a space marine, the Sisters of Battle still radiated strength and purpose. Despite his distaste for some of their methods, Eliseus found it hard not to feel a kinship with these warriors. He saw the reason for his reluctance in their eyes, for they glittered with a hostile fervor Eliseus would not have expected amongst supposed allies. As a chaplain, Eliseus was no stranger to impassioned oratory. His sermons were crafted to inspire fury and purpose in his brothers. But since his time in the clutches of the Dark Eldar on the Volgarar Reef, and everything he had witnessed during the Battle for Nocturne, his once brittle humours had veered away from the choleric. He believed he was a better spiritual leader because of it, but these two still retained an edge of religious fanaticism that Eliseus considered dangerous to any who failed to share it. By contrast, the third battle sister appeared less soul-hardened. She was younger, her hair longer than the other two, with streaks of velvet red in the black. She also wore a fluted jump pack, reminiscent of angel wings, marking her out as a seraphim. Eliseus had fought beside these shock troops before and knew them to be effective, dedicated warriors. This one had the rank insignia of a sergeant, or sister superior, in the less secular terminology of the Adepta Sororitas. Striding across the cracked flagstones of the partially ruined arena, the canoness and her charges were quickly before the two salamanders. "Blessings of the Saint Dominica upon you, chaplain," she addressed Eliseus with a slight bow, recognizing his spiritual authority before the actual secular command of Drakkard. "And you, captain," she conceded with a nod. "I am Canoness Angerer, preceptor of the Order of the Ebon Chalice." Though she spoke ostensibly in greeting, the canoness's words were like iron coming from her lips, her voice as stern as her bearing. "My sororitas," she began, gesturing to her retinue, who bowed as Angerer's gauntleted hand passed over them as if in benediction. "Sisters Superior Lavinius of my Celestian Guard." The scarred warrior glared icily, her fingers seeming to tighten on the book. "And Stefina of the Order Seraphim." She nodded to both warriors, hands by her sides, and within easy reach of the power blade she had sheathed next to her jump pack, and the plasma pistol belted at her waist. Eliseus hoped that it was just habit that made them so war-weary, or this alliance that was seemingly being proposed by the sisters' presence on Helitine would not be an easy one. Drakkard made curt introductions, explaining the other officers in his command cadre were either inbound or about to be linked to by Hololith. He did not waste time with pleasantries, preferring to explain quickly so he could move on to the obvious question.
What are you doing here on Helitine, Canoness Angaro? What brings the noble sisterhood of the Ebon Chalice to my battlefield?
Elysius sighed resignedly, the gesture hidden by the shadows. The meeting had not begun well.
A difficult alliance it is, then.
What the sisters wanted was precious little. As a holy world and part of the Ecclesiarchy's galactic protectorate, Helitine had several enshrined relics that would be better served far from the war zone and in the custody of the Sisterhood's convent prioress on Terra. Angara and her order were here to ensure the acquisition, protection, and transference of these relics. They had brought a preceptory to achieve this sacred task, which included over 600 Adepta Sororitas, the majority of those of the Order Militant, and a sizable armored force of immolators. According to Angara, her battle sisters were already being deployed in the muster field at the edge of Escadan City, along with the flame tanks. In openly discussing the disposition of her forces, Angara also pledged her sister hospitallers towards leavening the burden placed upon the Imperial Medicae by the war thus far. Furthermore, she added, if the Ebon Chalice could lend aid to the Adeptus Astartes in the prosecution of their sacred duty, then they would consider themselves doubly blessed.
It could explain the erratic occupation of the enemy, suggested Elysius after he had finished hearing what Angara had to say about the relics. Drakkard nodded, his eyes back on the map Hololith.
On Armageddon, the Orcs had deliberately befouled certain sites of religious significance, effectively rededicating them to their own brutish deities. None could say if such vile acts had any bearing on the spiritual conflict being fought across the entire world, if imperial belief was somehow weakened as a result, but it had dampened morale and sapped the courage of some. Where the Orcs erected their totems, where their crude sculptures of dung stood like dirty monoliths, blighting the air with their stench, the greenskins were harder to defeat. The Imperial allies on Helitine had yet to see or hear from the heretic leader. Some more credulous individuals believed it could be the War Master himself, but that was ridiculous. But his strategy might be to fight a war of faith to win a war of blood. Drakkard gestured to the areas of confluence on the map Hololith.
Can you determine which of these regions are also sites of religious significance?
Angara had a string of votive pearls in her grasp, 23 perfect white orbs that the canoness would later explain represented all the souls she had saved from darkness and brought to repentance. She had many such rosaries in her possession. This was the only one with a single black opal. As she smoothed the pearls between her fingers, Angara's lip curled, but the thin smile did not reach her eyes.
My sister Dialogus has already begun.
The Storm Raven touched down on a landing strip within sight of the amphitheatre. Iaptus had said nothing further during their short journey. Valin considered mentioning the sigils in the gun nest, but had no idea to what they portended, if anything. He also thought about voicing his concerns to his sergeant about Kaidak, but decided the matter was between him and Kaidak for now. So it was that they flew from the edge of Canticus to the heart of Escadan in silence, but with their thoughts far from quiescent. As soon as they disembarked, Valin noticed theirs was not the only transport to have alighted in such close proximity to the Imperial headquarters. Another, a black-armored rhino with an icon of a white chalice on its flanks, also stood idle at the edge of the landing apron. Its engines burred, giving off a faint heat wash as the vehicle readied for imminent departure. At a more distant landing zone, the main muster field for the Imperial forces, as well as its barracks, a host of those same black ships were in the midst of deployment. Varlin noticed several tanks amongst the disciplined squads of battle sisters.
"Armor and infantry," he observed. "The Sororitas are here in force, Brother Sergeant."
Though the main muster field was over a kilometer away, the rituals of blessing and piety being performed by the sisters were discernible, as were the bizarre war engines that came ambling out of their ships' holds, and the zealots who accompanied them. Blinded, festooned with devotional seals and the red raw wheels inflicted during self-flagellation, they appeared more like slaves than warriors. The engines were fashioned in the manner of walkers, bipedal and armed with various blades and saws. Some also carried what looked like short-range flamers. A whip-thin, emaciated wretch served as the only crew. Varlin found it difficult to tell if they were manning the machine or were bound to it as some form of torture. The others, those who marched sullenly alongside the walkers, were no better. They wore hoods in the form of masked inhibitor helms, and their lash-grafted arms hung slack by their sides, trailing in the dirt. Barefoot, their reedy bodies were half-naked and exposed to the elements.
"They are the penitent," said Iaptus when he noted Varlin's frown. "See."
He gestured to a cadre of chain-blade-wielding females and the mistress goading them from the ship with an energized lash.
"Faith can do strange things to the faithful, but it is nothing compared to its potential effects on those wishing to atone or punish themselves for transgression." "What kind of army is this?" asked Varlin, heedless of the disrespect he had just directed at the Sororitas.
Whilst they were talking, they had moved within the shadow of the amphitheatre. Its faded glory and obvious ruination were a microcosm of what was happening to Helotine.
"We are about to find out, brother," Iaptus replied.
Both Sergeant Xantho and Colonel Redgage, the commanding officer of the Cadian 81st, attended the war conference via Hololith. Their forms were rendered in grainy, static-laced amber light that emitted from projector ports located in the floor of Drakkard's command hub. A third figure joined them via Hololith, though his projection was much larger than the other two, and despite the fact his actual presence was many kilometers away in Canticus, entirely forbidding.
"No gains were made during our last sortie into the Western Districts."
The voice had once been that of a transhuman warrior, but was now rendered machine-like through Dreadnought's voxcasters that trembled the air even via Hololith. Khorad was immense, and his sarcophagus was a scaled carapace, replete with the honours of his previous incarnation as a brother captain of the Fireborn. Upon his hulking back, he wore the spines of the beast he had ritually killed for his ascension to the chapter. Its hide hung down like a tabard between two piston-driven legs. Twice he had been forced to quit his appointed posting within, initially to perform an undertaking of great honour, secondarily out of necessity and a desire to serve on. Khorad did not miss the touch of air upon his face, the feeling of heat against his bare skin. He did not care that he would never witness another sunrise or behold his brothers with his own eyes rather than the sensorium of his dreadnought tomb. Khorad, the warmaker, had no such misgivings about his transformation. As a flesh and blood salamander, he had lived for battle. Now he could fight on forever. Korad's left arm was gloved in a power fist that in turn clenched a thunder hammer. The right carried a weapon mount, a contemptor pattern heavy plasma, the wide muzzle shaped into a dragon's snout. His flamer would have been more appropriate to the iconography, but it lacked range and firepower for what Korad had in mind. Colonel Redgage, a thick-set man with a neat handlebar moustache and grey hair, was clearly still in the field. The edges of a war tent were revealed at the very extremity of the hololithic projection, and the dull but far-off sound of heavy mortar occasionally interrupted his reports. Korad, though, was at war during the conference, his grainy image showing him in battle. More than once, the resolution cut off midstream as a nearby explosion broke the link, and it was generally foul with smoke and airborne debris.
"The loss of the armor reduced our efficacy considerably, Captain. I strive to hold what we have already taken, but it is far from certain."
Korad led a heavy division comprising half of six companies' devastators and two other dreadnoughts. Snatches of missile salvos and the collimated streamers from heavy energy weapons intruded on the feed. The barrage from the devastators was intense and unremitting. They were a hammer, a means to pound the entrenched enemy into submission for the spear thrust of Xantho's tanks.
"If you shackle my hands, Captain, what else can I do but strain against it?"
The plan involving the heavy weapons unraveled spectacularly when all the salamander's armor was recalled from the western districts, and Korad was left with a static force, with no means of actually taking the ground they had spent so long pummeling. It had left the venerable warrior frustrated.
"I am a war maker, Captain, not a defensive bastion."
The hololith crazed once, then blinked out. Whether the link had been cut accidentally or deliberately would likely never be known. It left Drakkard seething at only static-charged air. The council had not gone well. Varlin and Iaptus had arrived in the midst of Xantho's report. Despite their victory at Canticus South, the tanks had achieved little but to shore up a ruin and prevent a slaughter. That in itself was reason enough to redeploy them, but it brought the salamanders no closer to a lasting victory on Helatine. Every engagement had been a frustrated one. Heretics were dug in, and the warren-like streets made for a complex hunting ground. Drakkard dearly wanted to burn them out, but he lacked the necessary manpower to conduct a citywide cleanse. Ambuscade complicated matters further, making the execution of a large-scale mission difficult. They were spread thin and unable to consolidate.
"You are at an impasse, brother captain," said Angera after she had heard the reports of all the officers. "And I sense the Emperor's divine providence in bringing us to Helatine to win this war of faith. Your salvation is at hand."
The physically present salamanders stiffened at this remark. Iaptus clenched his fists. Even Varlin felt his gorge rise at the canoness's remarks. Xantho and Redgage cut their hollow feeds. Only Elysius managed to remain neutral. Drakkard gave voice to the reason for the sudden hostility.
"Our salvation and inevitable victory shall be won with our blood and courage, as our gains in this war have been so far."
"Forgive me, brother captain," said Angera, bowing with false contrition. "I only refer to the ruins we saw upon our arrival of a city, no, a world in turmoil."
She made the sign of the Aquila, and never before had Drakkard found it so repellent.
"The Emperor is with you now. His light shines through us, his daughters. Surely even the stubborn pride of the salamanders would yield to an ally sent from the throne itself."
With the Adepta Sororitas tanks, with their warriors and material, they could launch an effective counterattack. A city-wide purge might be possible, but not under these conditions. Drakkar could not countenance that. He had expected trouble from the Ecclesiarchy troops, but not this arrogance and condescension.
"Salamanders yield to no one," he uttered through clenched teeth. "Even emissaries of the throne, you need to choose your words more wisely, sister."
Angera bowed again, but showed no remorse this time.
"I meant no slight or dishonor, but you are losing this war. Whether your faith is wanting or your arm unwilling, it does not matter."
"Wisely, sister," Drakkar warned her, echoing the belligerence felt by his men.
"It does not matter,"
Angera repeated, and would not be cowed.
"We are here. The Emperor is here."
Lavinius maintained a mask of austerity throughout, but the younger sister Stefina could not hide her concern at the sudden turn of events, her gaze flicking back between the space marines they had inadvertently annoyed. Angera was heedless of both.
"Relics of the Holy Ecclesiarchy are at rest beneath the rubble you have made of these temples and sanctuaries. I only pray they are still intact."
And now did she reveal the cause of her passive aggression.
"You are truly the hammer, aren't you, Captain Drakkard? It has fallen here on Helitine. A slayer of relics more than a slayer of heretics, I am afraid."
Drakkard half drew his sword. It was a saw-toothed cascara, with one serrated edge and the other a singular flat blade. The hilt was ornate, with a blended tellurium and gold banding for the grip. The pommel was a drake's tooth ripped from the maw of the beast, whose hide also served as Drakkard's cloak. It was sun-burnished and flashed like copper flame as it was unsheathed. Eliseus laid a hand on the cascara's pommel, preventing Drakkard from drawing it fully. When the captain glared back at him, the chaplain lightly shook his head. Realizing he was being baited, Drakkard regained his.
"Do not presume me to be a patient man, sister," he said to Angera. "I do not bear insult with reproach or restitution. You should know this about me."
Around the war council, both Iaptus and Varlin had drawn pistols in their hands. From the shadows, Drakkard's command squad became more than just bulky silhouettes as they emerged into the light. They too had weapons to hand. None would use them unless commanded. Drakkard did not need them to. The show of unity was enough.
"It is the same for my chapter," he explained needlessly.
Eliseus clutched the icon of a hammer he had bound to his armor with his ordinary hand and stared at the Adepta Sororitas, one servant of the imperial faith to another. Though his face was as stone, there was a depth of warning in his gaze. Angera seemed abruptly aware of her surroundings, all her bombast and self-righteousness having bled away like smoke. She licked her lips.
"Forgive us," she said,
holding up a placatory hand to show her sincerity.
"Our journey from Convent Prioris has been long and arduous. As I said, my dialogus..."
Angera gestured to Sister Lavinius, who carried a scroll fastened to her armor that she now unclasped and handed to the canoness.
"Has already begun the work of charting the position of known relics in Canticus. According to her study, a great many have been lost."
She read out a handful of names from the scroll to emphasize her point. The shawl of Palatius, Gerontium's blood, Saint Acretia's skull, the reliquary of Naga Dal. None amongst the salamanders had heard of them, not even Eliseus, and none cared much for the recitation either.
It weighs upon us all, the sundering of such artifacts that can never be replaced. Our religious ideology is a touchstone to this order, to every ordos sororitas. I came to you with closed fist, where I should have offered an open palm. Acting out her words, Angera opened her hand before Drakkard. I ask only that we be allowed to try to save our holiest relics.
Drakkard sheathed his sword and braced his hands against the edge of the hololith table. Mark here on this map the sites of your relics. Have your artifact keepers come and do it if needed. I want to know where they are to be found. He straightened then and walked around the map table to clench Angera's wrist in a warrior's grip, which the canoness reciprocated.
At least one thing you said was accurate, Drakkard allowed. We are at an impasse, and I am not so prideful that I don't see that or accept help if it is offered.
Angera was about to speak when Drakkard tightened his grip to let her know he had not finished.
Is it help you offer? An alliance, sister? My duty is to Helatine, and nothing will turn me or my warriors from its cause and the cause of its people.
Angera showed no discomfort, though she must have been in pain from the salamander's captain's iron grip. Instead, she nodded, her eyes meeting his.
You are different to other chapter Adeptus Astartes, Angera said.
Drakkard wore his helm, as always, when at war, so Angera would not have seen his smile, but she heard it well enough in his voice.
We are the epitome of them, sister.
Canoness Angera bowed to the warriors in her midst and took her leave with sisters Lavinius and Stefina. Outside the amphitheatre, a black-armoured Rhino APC awaited them, with its engines idling. Its hull was chipped and dented from recent combat, and there was dirt ingrained in the metal, but the icon of the ebon chalice still stood out proudly. Knowing this was where they parted ways, Sister Stefina turned to the canoness and clasped her hands in front of her chest. She was about to bow and receive benediction when Angera reached out to hold her clasped hands.
Sister, she began.
Stefina looked up. She was stern, but could not hide her youth and relative inexperience compared to the more veteran sisters.
My canoness.
Her voice was soft, but with an underlying strength. Her drill abbot had been a fearsome tyrant in the Schola, but he had taught Stefina well. She possessed a determination others lacked, but she had yet to find the true faith of the likes of Angera and Lavinius. She had yet to witness a manifestation of St. Alicia Dominica, as they had done.
Are you a daughter of the Emperor?
Angera asked her, as softly as her own harsh and grating cadence would allow. Up close, the canoness's votive incense was cloying, to the point of almost making Stefina gag. Stefina nodded.
And whose will do you serve?
I serve the Emperor's will, my canoness, she answered, still bowed.
And whose will do you serve on this mortal plane?
Now Stefina raised her eyes and saw both Angera and Lavinius a step farther back, watching her intently. Though she had served the Order of the Ebon Chalice for several years, proving her piety and devotion beyond reproach, she sensed her next answer to be an important one that presaged something more than the mere affirmation of duty. The rhino's engines grumbled, as if annoyed at the delay. Fumes plumed from its exhaust ports that reminded Stefina of grey censer smoke. The cloying incense threatened to make her eyes water. This suddenly seemed very much like a test of faith. No, Stefina corrected herself inwardly with a hint of shame at the weariness she felt of loyalty. I follow the orders of you, my canoness,
she said, choosing her words carefully. Angara smiled thinly, but it was a false thing, a mask to hide a very different emotion.
You are a dutiful servant, a dedicated warrior.
I am as you and Madril Abbot made me to be. The smile faded like winter sun before a cloud.
Indeed, said Angara. I have a duty for you now, sister. Is your will and your faith up to it, I wonder?
Stefina was not sure why her will and faith were being put to the question, but she answered in the affirmative.
I need you to watch the Adeptus Astartes.
Stefina's face wrinkled with confusion.
Watch them, my canoness?
Yes. Observe everything they do, every ritual they partake in, and their rites of battle.
But why?
Stefina clamped her mouth, realizing her error. She had spoken without thinking and had failed her canoness's test. She would be found wanting. Saint Alicia Dominica would not appear before her, even though she was Seraphim. Lavinius looked shocked and about to rebuke Stefina for her unintended insolence, but Angara forestalled the Celestian's chiding with surprising sanguinity.
Because I do not know them, said Angara,
and now she showed the truth of her emotions at last, as her face became hard and unyielding as ice.
Because I do not trust them. We embark on a mission of faith, sacred to his ecclesiarchy. They are diabolic savages who worship fire and burn the bodies of their dead. We must be mindful. You are my eyes and ears in this, Stefina. So I ask again, do you have the will and faith for this solemn charge?
Now Stefina nodded at once, glad she had avoided the canoness's ire, but fearful any slowness in answering would also condemn her.
I am, my canoness.
Angara looked over Stefina's shoulder, beyond the dark fluting of her angelic jump pack, and up into the murky sky crowding Escadan.
Then go and do the Emperor's work. Fly, my warrior angel.
Angara stood back to give Stefina her benediction before the Seraphim was airborne on wings of ebon night. The others watched her go, trailing tongues of flame in her wake. Lavinius drew up alongside Angara, the book clenched firmly in her gauntleted grasp.
Should we tell her, canoness?
Angara lowered her gaze to ground level again, to where the war was being fought in distant Canticus.
She would not understand, sister. She does not possess the same faith as you or I.
Angara paused to turn. She touched her armored fingers to the vicious scar on Lavinius's face, the one that had nearly taken her eye. It was jagged, as if done with a blunt blade, claws, or nails.
Besides, we each have a personal stake in this, don't we?
Lavinius nodded slowly. Her gaze strayed to a small glass phial attached to the canoness's trappings. A clear, shimmering liquid was contained within. Then she, too, touched the wound on her face, almost absently. The pain of Lavinius's injury, her scarred appearance, it was a daily reminder of how she had once lowered her guard. She vowed it would not happen again. She clenched the book at the memory of her wounding, imagining it to be the neck of the one who had tried to maim her, and lifted her gaze.
Are you certain, Sister Lavinius?
Asked Angara, nodding to the book. It was not really a question.
She is in the Book of Names, as prophesied by Saint Dominica. Indeed she is.
Though Lavinius betrayed no outward sign, Canoness Angara felt the question on her lips.
What is it, sister? You have served the Order faithfully for many years. You have earned the right to speak your mind.
Lavinius bowed her head, showing contrition and acknowledging the wisdom of her canoness.
How do we know? How can we be sure she is here?
Angera smiled benevolently, the way a mother smiles at a daughter when she knows her child is being foolish.
We do not need to know. We only have to believe, and all that requires, dear sister, is faith.
Angera maintained her smile, but as she narrowed her eyes, the tone of it seemed to subtly change as a measure of her hatred for their quarry was revealed.
Remember, Lavinius, hell spawn can wear many masks. Some even clothe themselves in righteousness to ward the faithful sword from their necks. But we are not fooled by such glamours, are we?
No, Canoness.
No,
Angera agreed, a cold glint in her eyes at the thought of that faithful sword doing its holy work.
No, we are not.
After the departure of the Adepta Sororitas, Drakgard had dismissed the others too. He was walking back wearily to quarters he had set aside for his own private contemplations, when Eliseus's voice arrested him.
Would you have struck her down, brother?
Drakgard paused. He was halfway down an unlit corridor, a branch that fed off from the amphitheatre and led to a small barracks room. There was no accusation in the chaplain's tone, merely matter-of-fact inquiry.
No, he lied. I meant only to declare my anger at her ill-chosen rhetoric. Was it so poorly chosen?
Drakkar turned quickly, the color of his earlier mood returning.
You think she was right?
Eliseus stood before him with open palms.
No, but I think you believe she might have had a point. Salvation? You latched onto that word. I've seen your doubt, brother. This campaign has been overlong and much more arduous than it had any right to be. You question whether we are in need of some divine providence. Perhaps we are. We have yet to even set eyes on their master. He or it is here, Urzan. Rest assured of that. Then show me to him, Eliseus, and I will end this war.
The chaplain held up a placatory hand.
Patience, brother. We must endure, as always.
Drakgard's shoulders sagged a little, even in his armor, and he unfastened his helmet. Even in the darkness, his scar-ravaged features were hideous. His humors rebalanced, veering back towards the phlegmatic.
Should we not be enough? That is all I ask. Whether this war would have been ended by our hand alone is a moot point now, brother. We will never know. The Ebon Chalice are here and at our disposal.
Drakkar's eyes widened incredulously.
You believe that?
Eliseus conceded the point with a tilt of his head.
Well, perhaps at our disposal is stating it too strongly. Pragmatically, we are reinforced, and we of Nocturne's heart blood are ever the pragmatists.
Drakgard nodded, and Eliseus saw the weariness in his eyes.
You realize, of course, that you will have to treat with her again.
He nodded again, all too aware that both forces needed to agree on strategy before any meaningful blow against the Black Legion could be struck.
Do you trust them, Eliseus?
He asked, a captain to his chaplain. Eliseus's reply was emphatic.
No, brother, I do not.
It was warm in the barracks house and dark. The scent of burning metal pricked the air, adding to its heat. In one corner, smoke thronged the mouth of a small furnace. The coals within glowed a dull fire red. Brought all the way from Nocturne, from the slopes of Mount Deathfire, the coals represented rebirth and transformation.
Fire changes all, as old Zende
used to say.
Etar, Drakgard rasped, breathing deep of the smoke and cinder smell. It eased him and acted like a balm. A hooded Brander priest stepped into view. His head was bowed, the instruments of his sacred calling clenched in thin, wiry hands. Every Fireborn had a Brander priest. It was he or she that would scour the flesh, burn in the deeds of duty, and embed forever the ignominies of defeat. For a salamander's skin was his legacy, and his mortal tapestry of remembrances. Like many chapter warriors had subalterns, minor equerries, or auxiliaries, the Fireborn had the Brander priests, or incendum cesserii, as some knew them. It was an old term, rapidly growing out of fashion, but Drakgard was an old warrior and had tastes to match. They were armorers as well as priests, and some amongst the chapter even called upon them for counsel. Drakgard had only ever uttered his own Brander priest's name. It was not that he thought Etar was beneath him. It was simply all the communication that was needed between them. As Drakgard held out his arms, Etar took it as a signal to stow his branding iron in a rack on the wall and went to his master. It took almost an hour to remove the armor, and Drakgard grimaced at every plate extracted from his body. A litany of scar tissue was revealed beneath, merging with the brands that also colonized Drakgard's flesh. He remembered every one, knew every wound, and relived it acutely when he was stood naked in readiness for the blessing of the furnace. He stepped forwards, limping with the knotted muscle and twisted skin of his right thigh. Smoke and heat fell upon him like a purifying veil as he felt the soles of his bare feet start to burn. A metal plate sat adjacent to the furnace, absorbing its heat. Drakgard stood on it, arms held by his sides, fists bunched as he breathed deep of the fiery vapors. It was only now, during the ritual of branding, that the dull ache of his injuries abated. Pain to cleanse pain. Only this was the purer. Drakgard bowed his head, eyes now shut, as he entered deep meditation. He heard the scrape of metal against stone as Etar took up the brand again and thrust it into the furnace. It would take a few minutes to reach the temperature he needed it to. Drakgard awaited its touch, welcoming it.
"Bring the fire,"
he willed, a brief cessation to the dull agony he lived with day in and day out. "Let it burn." Thus far, the war on Helitein had been long. It was to get longer.